Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Caroline Lucas. She's an almost singular voice in UK politics, being the only current Green Party MP in Westminster representing Brighton Pavilion. But as two-time leader of the Greens, her influence across a movement ever more relevant amid the climate crisis is one that few in politics can ignore. She has a new book, Another England, which explores the rise of nationalism in England and the country's cultural and literary history, asking, is it time to tell a new story? She was recently live on stage at London's Tabernacle for our Intelligence Squared live event. Caroline was in conversation with the economics and political commentator, journalist and author Grace Blakely. Grace's new book is Vulture Capitalism. This is a conversation in two parts, and Intelligence Squared members can get all installments right now. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, and you'll get the extended version of Caroline and Grace's conversation right now, plus all our extra content and ad-free listening. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now let's join Grace Blakely speaking to Caroline Lucas live on stage in London.
Thank you very much, Mia, and thanks to Intelligence Squared for organising, and thank you to all of you for coming out on a slightly colder than anticipated day. I am so thrilled to be here today with the absolutely fantastic Caroline Lucas. I'm on stage with her for the second time this week. We were at the Cambridge Literary Festival the other day debating whether or not Starmerism was sufficiently radical. So you can imagine that Caroline and I were both on the same team. But today we are here, of course, to discuss her absolutely fantastic new book, Another England. I was privileged enough to get an early copy of this and you know, read through the whole thing. And her passion, I think, for literature and for the arts and for England, actually, really came through spectacularly. So I'm gonna let Caroline read an extract from the book before we go into questions.
Thank you so much, Grace, and thank you for coming. Yes, so I'm not gonna read much, but just a page and a half from the preface, which just kind of sets the scene, I think. London at dawn. The Thames is in full flood. Its muddy waters turned to a deep blue by the cloudless sky above. The rising sun is picking out every detail of the Palace of Westminster, its honey-coloured limestone now golden, transforming what is too often a museum of pomp and empty circumstance into something startlingly beautiful. I'm standing on Westminster Bridge looking east towards the towers of the City of London, to Essex and Kent and beyond to Europe. I'm there to film a short message, and now as I watch the recording again, 8 years later, I realise I look like someone who's just heard of the death of a friend or a relative. I'm profoundly sad, perhaps a little shocked. I'm also deeply tired because I've been up all night. I look like I don't quite know what to say. I say, I know, like me, you'll be feeling pretty devastated this morning. Just a few hours earlier, I had watched David Dimbleby report the result of the referendum on the UK's continuing membership of the European Union. After all the millions of words spent during the campaign, the result came at 4:39 a.m. on the 24th of June, 2016. We're out. Sometimes when you're tired or in shock, things can gain a strange clarity. In my video message, I said, people have voted the way they did, I think, partly because they were feeling so angry and alienated, and the divisions in this country run so deep. And if we're ever to have a chance of healing those divisions, the progressives have got to work together. In one way, that moment on Westminster Bridge feels a lifetime ago. Our country has gone through so much since, and if anything, the alienation and polarisation are much greater today than back in 2016. But the truth was clear even then. Brexit was the result of division, and it would make those divisions worse. The fact that England and Wales voted to leave and Scotland and Northern Ireland to stay has put incredible strain on the myth that the United Kingdom is an equal partnership of four nations. The government in London decided what form Brexit would take without any reference to the elected governments in Edinburgh or Belfast or indeed in Cardiff. Unsurprisingly, support for the reunification of Ireland has grown. The pressure for a second independence referendum in Scotland can't be ignored forever. In Wales, a new sense of national identity is on the rise. The future of the United Kingdom itself is now in doubt.
Thank you. Thanks for that extract, Caroline. I think that sets up our conversation quite well. And the first thing I was going to ask you about before we touch on those themes that you were discussing around, you know, Brexit and democracy in England, was just to ask you, given that we're coming up to St. George's Day and that Keir Starmer has recently penned an article claiming that he's extremely proud to be English, and that Labour is now the party of English patriotism. What are your thoughts on that? And what kind of patriotism is he referencing explicitly or implicitly?
Yes, thank you. So that was a very topical article that Keir had in the Telegraph yesterday. And just what struck me when I was reading the article was that he totally confuses England and Britain throughout the article. So one minute he's talking about England, the next minute he's talking about Britain, and not really making any distinction between the two. And it's also pretty insular, I have to say, as well, that it's very much about the English pub and the English countryside and not much more. And I suppose my reflection on that was that it is interesting how there is, actually, it's a phrase that John Denham uses. John Denham, who used to be a Labour MP and now heads up a department at Southampton University on English identity. But he calls it Anglo-centric English nationalism. And it's sort of that sense that what's good for Britain is somehow, or rather the other way around, what's good for England is automatically good for Britain. And the way in which England and Britain get elided the whole time, I think is probably very frustrating if you're Scottish or Welsh or from Northern Ireland. And it just speaks to this sort of unease and discomfort that people on the left, I think, have with England. And I think that matters because we know that the right does not share that discomfort. The populist right is very happy to exploit English national consciousness and to tell a story of England that's all about exceptionalism and imperial nostalgia and cheerleading for Brexit. And for as long as we on the, as I say we, but those of us on the progressive left or centre-left, whatever you want to say, those of us on the left, for as long as we feel squeamish about even getting onto the pitch and having that debate, then in a sense we cede that whole ground to the right and we allow them to dictate what Englishness is. And, you know, if you listen to Boris Johnson or whatever, then all you really learn is that England is basically better than anyone else. You know, he blathers on about world beating this, that, and the other. And we've got to be able, I think, to tell some different stories about England, something that's more compelling and resonant. Because otherwise, if we just leave it to the right, then we miss out on an incredibly important way of reaching people's hearts and their minds. And it doesn't work simply to come up with technocratic answers or you know, not appealing to people's emotions. I think there is a real role for storytelling, myth-making, you know, communicating in ways that aren't simply evidence-based facts. Those are really important. I'm a great fan of evidence-based facts, but we need to be able to tell some stories too.
I would really like to read your reply to Keir Starmer's article in The Telegraph. I think you should pitch that one. Point
We're doing it. We're on the case.
Okay, good. So the book is just fantastically written. It's really lyrical, and it draws on this long history of the English classics. You studied literature, and your passion for literature is very evident. I really wanted to know, while reading it, which of these texts, or indeed any of the kind of English classics, is your favourite and why?
Well, the poetry is probably my favourite, to be honest. And so one of the chapters in the book is about the importance of place, because one of the issues around England, or indeed around the UK too, but particularly in England, is that we are such a centralised country. And it feels as if many places feel as if the pride that they have in those places aren't really reflected in having the powers that they would like in order to be able to really have a great influence in what happens in those places. And so one of the poets that I love is Edward Thomas, and he is a fantastic poet of place. And the poem that you probably will have heard of is Adlestrop. It was that poem that is about a train journey where the train stops in this station called Adlestrop, and what he remembers about that. And it's very poignant because it's at the time of the First World War. And it's just an incredibly beautiful poem. But place feels to me something that we ignore at our peril. We know that, you know, there is such a sense now that people want to be able to, you know, have the flag of St. Piran if they're in Cornwall, or have the pound in Stroud, have their own currencies and so on. And I don't think we need to feel threatened by that. I think that's a very positive way of loving the place that you're from, as long as it's inclusive too. And so I think the issue around the kind of England that I would love to see and the stories I would love to see us tell about England are far more inclusive stories than perhaps the ones that those on the right tell. And one example of that I pick up in the book, for example, is, you know, the writer always talking about the Battle of Britain and plucky Britain and so forth. Well, if you look at the Battle of Britain, then 1 in 10 of those RAF pilots were actually refugees from Nazi Europe. So it's quite important that we challenge some of the stories that are coming from the right and remind ourselves that a different tradition has been here for a long time.
When we're talking about these classic texts and their centrality to this story that we tell ourselves about England, do you think that they're sufficiently accessible? And if not, how could we try and kind of broaden this conversation and broaden access to many of these classic texts, which I think it's fair to say a lot of people won't have encountered in the public education system?
I mean, I should just say, as by way of preface, that I'm not suggesting that literature or classics needs to be the way into feeling our way into those other stories of England. It's just that for me, as someone who studied literature, that's where I look to begin with. But for others, it might well be sport, and you know, the English football team is pretty much the epitome of inclusiveness and multiculturalism and all that's best in England, I think. So the first thing to say is it doesn't need to be literary. And secondly, yes, I do talk about the classics in there, but we've got P.D. James, we've got Neville Shute. It's not just about the classics. So I hope it's a slightly broader broader set of texts that I draw on. And yes, you're right. Are some of those going to feel a bit exclusive to people? I have to hold my hand up. Maybe sometimes they will. But maybe also, when they're put in the context that I've tried to do in the book, then maybe it's another way of approaching them. So it's a way that perhaps people, you know, who wouldn't necessarily pick up a text because they're told it's a classic, might just be interested. So, for example, on the chapter about inequality and the importance of addressing that and the role in which work plays in addressing that, yes, I look at some of the classics of Charles Dickens, but also point out where he kind of doesn't go the whole way in terms of the logical analysis that perhaps he brings to it. So Charles Dickens, as we know, is a really fantastic champion for better conditions in Victorian England, and through a novel like Oliver Twist, you know, he will remind us just how squalid so many of the conditions in Victorian England were, in London in particular. But his solution, basically, is to unveil Oliver as having been, all along, a member of the gentry. it's not actually to change the status quo with the slums and everything in London. It's to just make sure that his hero turns out to be someone who can have a very comfortable life, because they're not actually from the working class, after all. Compare that with someone like Elizabeth Gaskell, writing more or less at the same time. And she wrote novels like North and South and Mary Barton. And in those, what's very exciting about those is that she's absolutely got the working class people who are front and center of the novels. They're the heroes and the heroines of the novels. And organized labor is absolutely seen as the way to kind of fight back against inequality and fight back against exploitation of working people. So I hope that the book is one way of perhaps making some of those texts a little bit more accessible than they might otherwise have been.
Yeah, I think you do a fantastic job of that.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The next thing I want to discuss is something that has been on my mind a lot recently, and I've been talking about a lot recently, which is this theme of powerlessness. And this came through, I think, throughout the book in your conversations about democracy, about post-Brexit, about, you know, the different parts of the union. And I was wondering what you meant when you were talking about this sense of powerlessness and how you think it's affecting our politics.
Mm. So just to give a bit of context to that, so shortly after that time on Westminster Bridge, when I was absorbing the information that we had, the Remain site had lost that referendum, then in order to try to make sense of it, I travelled to as many Leave places as I could with a little team from my office. We called this project Dear Leavers, and we went to Dudley and to Dagenham and to Huddersfield and the Isle of Wight and places like that, and just sat with people and listened to what they loved about the places they came from, what they were worried about, and indeed why they voted Leave. And there were just these two themes that came out almost everywhere. And the first one was about pride. So there was a real pride, for example, in Dudley for its industrial heritage, and rightly so. But then it was this powerlessness. And I think what people were meaning when they talked about that was just a sense that their concerns weren't being heard in the corridors of power, that London could as well be in another planet for all it had any relevance to their lives. And how that powerlessness manifested itself, I mean, partly because as we know, power has been drained from local authorities. Anywhere where local people could influence power, really, has now gone back up to London. So we've seen this huge power grab by, well, this government in particular, the last 14 years of Tory government in particular. But it's been going on longer than that, I would argue. And so it's partly just that sense about how do you change anything? How do you make anything different happen? And so I think any kind of settlement for England going forward would have to see a major part of proper devolution of powers within England, so that people would have a better chance of having at least some kind of influence over it. Of course, there's power in other ways too. It doesn't have to be through the election of local authority representatives, but it felt too that the resources simply weren't there. So one could imagine things like citizens' assemblies and other ways of people's voices being heard. But again, it just didn't feel as if the social capital had been invested by others in terms of enabling that process to happen. And yet when it does happen, it's incredibly exciting. And one of the things that I compare that with was, I was part of an IPPR commission on environmental justice, which was basically, it's a bit of a mouthful, but essentially, again, going to some of those places that are going to be most affected by the loss of jobs that are currently in fossil fuel industries or high carbon industries. And one of the conditions I made for being part of that IPPR commission was that they should have citizens' assemblies in those places, like in Aberdeen and others, so that people's voices could be heard about what they wanted to see in terms of the transition in their communities. And what was so wonderful about that was that, people came up with really exciting plans for what they wanted to see, but B, just the process of being asked to be involved in this endeavour was just transformative. And it's been so interesting to see how people's lives have changed, because they, you know, once you've been given a voice, or at least your voice has been allowed to be heard, and you don't have to be given it, but yeah, having it be heard, I think that really begins to change things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've really noticed that as well in studying things around like community organising and community wealth building, and the way in which these things don't just allow people to kind of, you know, influence policy at the local level, or, you know, change the way that buses are being franchised or whatever, but actually cut back against this pervasive sense of individualism that tells us we're all isolated and competing against one another, and really pushes back with this sense of collective power and collective identity. And I think that is another theme that comes through the book as well. It's how we kind of connect this like abstract idea of England as an identity with something that's really felt, and as you said, something that connects pride and place and power, actually. And yeah, I was kind of wondering how you imagined that like local people could really start to mobilize in order to like change their places from the ground up, as well as all the things that we've discussed about, you know, devolution and how we would change democracy from the top down. What are some of the things that you are excited about when you look at kind of community organizing today?
I mean, there are just so many fantastic examples of people coming together to change things. And, you know, whether it's something like allotment movements, you know, when people are beginning to push back on some of the issues around land ownership, or if they're taking part in the right to roam and saying, hang on a minute, why is it in England that we only have a legal right of roaming on access land of just 8% of England, whereas in Scotland there's a comprehensive right to roam, and the assumption is that up there you have access to the land unless there's a good reason for you not to have. And that's fair enough if you've got, you know, lambing going on in a particular field or whatever. But by and large, the assumption is that you do have that right to roam. Here in England, as I say, right to roam on just 8% of English land, 3% of rivers. We owe a bit of a debt of gratitude to a rather unusual person, which is Alexander Darwall, who was the landowner in Dartmoor, who owns loads of Dartmoor, and suddenly decided that he didn't like the idea that people could wild camp on Dartmoor anymore. And the mobilisation that's given to the campaign for a right to roam has been fantastic, as people who might never have dreamt of going to wild camp on Dartmoor, now they know that that's the last place that it's been allowed, and he's trying to take it away from us. You know, they're out there in force. So it's done a great debt of service to that campaign. So there's lots going on, I think, about land. Obviously lots going on around climate, but from the bottom up, and not, you know, not necessarily thinking about parts per million and targets and so forth, but just about how communities could come together, for example, and if they did come together, how they might be able to get a cheaper deal when it comes to insulating homes, something as basic as that. So I think there are some really exciting processes going on. The trick is to harness them and connect them up and really give them a push.
So a central part of the story that we tell ourselves about England is this idea of England as this green and pleasant land, right? And you speak about Jerusalem as a song, which I also love as a song, actually, for my sins. But I think, and the way that England is presented in this song and in this kind of vision that we have of Englishness is almost kind of a small c conservative approach to environmentalism. It is literally the impulse to conserve the natural environment, which has often historically been juxtaposed with a liberal idea of progress and, you know, development and that sort of thing. But it is still something that people hold quite closely, their idea of this kind of green England and the kind of conservation of nature. But up until recently, that was actually something that was benefiting the Conservative Party, because a lot of people associate, you know, they've got the tree as their logo and people associate kind of conservatism with rural England. And it wasn't up until a few years ago that people actually did pick the Tories as the party that was kind of potentially going to be the best on climate. So how do you think we can connect this kind of romantic image of rural England and, you know, wanting to protect the land with the more radical environmental movement? Mm.
Now, one of the sort of paradoxes that I explore in the book is the fact that on the one hand, we do pride ourselves on being a nation of countryside lovers and nature lovers, and yet we're also, on a lot of indicators, one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. And we're also, and I think it's not unconnected to that, one of the nations where people don't feel connected to the natural world. And one of the reasons I explore in that, and there's a lot going on there, obviously, but it is quite interesting that all too often it feels as if the countryside and the natural world is somehow distant from us. It's separate from us. It's something we look at from a train window or from a pathway where we are allowed to be, but it's somehow other. And interestingly, just now, in fact, there's a campaign that's being run by Lawyers for Nature, I think they're called, and they are trying to change the Oxford English Dictionary definition of nature, because in the OED, nature is defined as something as being to do with plants and animals and not humans. And I think, although it might sound a bit philosophical, it feels to me as if that way of treating the natural world as if it's something separate from us, it's an object we're the subject to often, and therefore we do stuff to nature without realizing we're doing it to ourselves. So when we pollute the air, then we're actually polluting our own bodies, as we know. So on a very literal level, we're doing it to ourselves. But there is something about this division between us and the natural world. And George Monbiot, with his usual form of words, had quite a strong way of putting this when he said that he thought that poetry was one of the biggest threats to life on Earth. And you kind of think, what? But what he meant by that, I think, was that, again, in so much of the literature, it reinforces this idea of the countryside being other, something that we observe. And in the book, I compare two poets. So on the one hand, you've got someone called William Cowper, who sits on his log, lamenting the fact that the log was once a tree, but now it's been cut. But actually, you kind of get the sense that you know, cutting the log and cutting the tree and make it into a log for him to sit on was fine, because it gives him the pretext for the poem, and he can talk about how it used to be. But it's very much about nature out there. And I contrast that with John Clare, who's another poet whom I love, and he was around in the sort of 1790s, beginning of the 1800s, at the time of enclosures. So this was when his own village and all around him was basically being kind of privatized by the land being taken away from working people. And in his poetry, by contrast, it's the most extraordinary poetry, where it all weaves together, and the observer of nature and the natural world itself are all totally engaged, and it's messy and complicated, and you know, the verbs and the subclauses all pile up on one another, and it's almost as if within the format of the poem itself, it kind of encapsulates this idea of being at one with nature. So that's the kind of philosophical answer. And I suppose a more practical answer as well would be, one of the things I'm pleased about that I've managed to do in Parliament is get the government to agree to a GCSE, a new GCSE in natural history. And my reason for doing that was a concern that, again, our young people in particular quite often have a real kind of disconnect with the natural world. And I read somewhere that, you know, prisoners spend more time outside than the many young people, because we're worried about them as parents, or they're not getting that kind of access through school and so forth. And so a natural history GCSE would be a really kind of empirical type of qualification, where you're really getting the soil under your fingers, under your fingernails. You are not just learning about systems of life, which is what biology will teach you, but actually about the individual flora and fauna. So you can name that plant, you can name that animal, which we know at the minute lots of people can't, and feel that intimacy with it and that connection with it. And it echoed something that I read from a US writer, Richard Louv, who wrote this book called Last Child in the Wood. And he said, we won't protect what we don't love, and we won't love what we don't know, and we won't know what we don't feel and touch and smell and taste and so on. And that kind of felt quite true, that in a way that access to nature, whether it's through the GCSE or whether it's through the right to roam or anything else, that those kinds of engagement with the natural world probably are pretty important in terms of equipping us to feel that we love it so much more, and therefore we'll be more likely to be out there on the barricades protecting and restoring it. So not just conserving it, but doing more than that.
Yeah, I loved that you also mentioned the John Donne poem, my favourite poem, For Whom the Bell Tolls, yeah. Which makes a similar sort of message, you know, do not ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. We're all part of this island, and we're all kind of interrelated, and that includes nature as well.
Yeah.
So you spend, as we've just heard in the extract that you spoke about, you spend a fair bit of time talking about the potential breakup of the United Kingdom. How likely do you actually think this is going to be? And do you think it would be a force for good? And I actually, you talk about England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. I actually live in Cornwall, so I'm also wondering where Cornish independence features in this picture.
That's a very good question. How likely do I think it is? Well, I think, at the very least, it is a reasonable possibility that within a generation, Scotland probably could have become independent, not least because of the demographics. So, you know, you might look at the SNP and think, well, they're not doing terribly well right now in Scotland, which is true. But the demographics alone, I think, would lead you to think that within 20 years, it's certainly not impossible that Scotland could become independent. I think it's interesting now with Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, and Michelle O'Neill has quite openly said that she could imagine before 2030 that the conditions would be such that a referendum could be held about reuniting Ireland. Wales, I think, there is more of a concern about Welsh nationalism now, and in the commission that was recently set up to look at the future of Wales, an independent Wales was being mentioned for the first time. So it feels to me like it's certainly not a dead cert, but I would have thought we should at least start thinking about it. And it's so interesting to me that in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, this is a live discussion. Whereas in England, we're doing what we always do, which is just to kind of, you know, keep our eyes down and just carry on as if nothing's going to happen, because, you know, we haven't kind of quite caught up with it yet. And we saw what happened when we did that over Brexit. I was really struck by the fact that David Cameron apparently had actually sent out an edict to all departments in Whitehall to say that they were not allowed to prepare for the possibility that the vote would be to leave. So unsurprisingly, you know, it was even more chaotic than it perhaps needed to be. You know, if it is going to happen, then I think we should start thinking about, well, what does that mean for England? You know, what is going to be left? Is that England that's going to be left going to be, you know, more of a kind of inward-looking little England? Or could it be something that's much more confident and outward-looking and recognising indeed that maybe our future does indeed rest with the rest of the EU? So having those conversations, I think, are important. Your question about whether or not it's going to be a good thing or not is an interesting one. I mean, I think you could make the case that in some ways England is kind of constrained by this construct of Great Britain, because Britain pretty much was a construct, that it was designed really, I think, to mean that people perhaps wouldn't notice quite so much that we were annexing Scotland and then we annexed Wales. And, you know, we've had that kind of imperialism, not just further afield, but right on our own doorsteps. So Britain was kind of constructed to be something that we could feel more inclusive about. But it's also quite a heavy yoke in terms of the baggage that accompanies it. And so I think it's perfectly possible to imagine an England with an English Parliament that would feel more comfortable in its own skin, where it would feel less squeamish about even talking about its own identity. But if we're ever to get to that point, then those conversations, it feels to me, need to start now, because they are already starting in all those other, or at least they're not starting, they're well underway in the other three nations of the United Kingdom. And yeah, I think England just needs to wake up and start to have the conversation.
That kind of connects to the next question I wanted to ask you, actually, because it links to, you know, the UK's status as a great power, basically, which is in any case under, well, it's falling away, basically. We're in this moment of really profound geopolitical transformation with, you know, the decline of US dominance over the world economy, and with that of the UK. And these are often really dangerous moments for national storytelling. You know, the Trumpian thing of make America great again. It's a kind of, you know, a wink to the idea that America is in decline. And those kind of reactionary forces tend to make a lot of hay in those contexts. So how can we hope to build a progressive patriotism in the context of a nation that, in a lot of ways, whether you look at that in terms of geopolitics or whether you look at that just in terms of the public realm, economic growth, you know, the legacy of austerity, feels like it's in decline?
I think that's a really good question. And I think that it is exactly those conditions that mean that it's even more important than we do, because those conditions that you've described are such fertile conditions for the rise of a harder right, of an even more populist right than we already have. And therefore, I think having those stories and discussions about a different form of politics is vital. Otherwise, the right will do what they always do. They know the importance of national consciousness, and they will manipulate that if we haven't started to have the conversation first. And it really worries me that in many ways it feels as if we've not quite woken up to just what a dangerous moment this is in our own history. So you've rightly, you know, reminded us of what's happening in the US with Trump. But, you know, I don't know that many people would have expected, even here, that in the last few years we'd have seen such attacks on lawyers, you know, the lefty lawyers, or public broadcasters, or the right to strike, or the right to peaceful protest, or the kinds of attacks we're seeing right now on immigrants, where, you know, you're going to send your asylum seekers off to Rwanda if the government gets its way a little bit later this evening. So if we join up the dots of that, I think these are really, really dangerous times. And therefore, having a narrative that allows us to imagine a different kind of country and a different set of values, and to make the connection to where we've had that before, so it's not just some sort of unrooted vision, but it's actually something where we can see a tradition of where, for example, we've had in this country a passionate campaign from the Chartists onwards for rights for well, they didn't have women then, but anyway, they would have done if they were Chartists today. So anyway, an extension of human rights. We've had such a long tradition about getting more access to the land. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the Charter of the Forest, which was this extraordinary document of 1217 that people used to learn about, and we don't anymore. Magna Carta 1215, most school kids are taught about, and that enshrined our political rights. Just 2 years later, related to it, there was the Charter of the Forest, which gave people just extraordinary access to, and extraordinary now as we look back at it, access to land and so forth, which is part of a tradition that we had. And so it feels to me that the more we can actually remind ourselves that there has been this more radical, progressive movement in England, then perhaps the easier it will be to refind it.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Mia Sorrenti and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up, and members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue, featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.